Hi, and welcome to another episode of Heroes in Our Midst. I'm Michelle Sawatsky Coop, and if you take the time to look and listen, you'll see that the last five of our six stories have highlighted Paralympians. It's taken us to sports like wheelchair basketball and rugby, swimming, and now we visit the track. Well, I didn't literally visit the track, but it was during the summer of 2020, when normally we would have been watching the Paralympics on TV, that I met with someone whose familiarity with the track spans decades. Colin Matheson's first Paralympic appearance was in 1996 in Atlanta, Georgia. And he was supposed to be competing in the 2020 Paralympics this past summer. So he is now aiming for the 2021 Games. He says they will be his last. I guess we'll see. I had a great time sitting down with Colin, and when we did, he told me his story. And we started at the very beginning.
The very beginning was in 1983. I lived on the Manitoba Marathon course. I watched the gladiators of that era pushing their way in the last third of the marathon through St. Vitale at 6:30 in the morning, and it was absolutely inspirational. All I wanted to know is how could I go as fast as them and get shoulders like that?
Incredible. So how old were you then?
I would have been five or six years old.
Wow. And were you in a wheelchair right from day one?
Yeah, I was born with spina bifida, and that resulted in me needing a wheelchair for my primary mode of transportation. I walked with braces for a little bit, but it wasn't all that it was cracked up to be.
Is there a story there for your mom, for your parents, how they felt and how they, you know, even at the very beginning, how you felt about your outlook on life? What was that like in your home?
Well, that Manitoba Marathon as a reference point was the beginning of me being active, and my family was extremely active. My parents were athletes in the past, and it was going to be you're going to be active. We don't care how, but you're going to be active. And I was really fortunate to not only see these amazing athletes at the Manitoba Marathon, but also find out that there were several of them training in Winnipeg. So all of a sudden, I had myself a peer group. I had myself some amazing local idols and some role models, and a really amazing junior program that was facilitated by a guy by the name of Doug Grant, who happened to be one of the Manitoba Marathon competitors.
Yeah. So someone you probably saw and someone you watched.
Yep. Yeah, he was an amazing figure growing up. He was the executive director of Manitoba Wheelchair Sports for many years, and just an amazing champion of wheelchair sports and an awesome guy.
So, Colin, how did you get in contact with him, and how did you get started? Did you guys just sign up?
I was part of this junior program, and it was nothing more than the fundamentals of sport, where it was games at the Grant Park High School. You know, and we would play British Bulldog, we would play tag, we would play, basketball, all of the sort of the fundamentals. And at that point, it was, that you arrive at a moment very, very quickly that you want to specialize in something. You like everything, but there's something that really, really sort of gets you excited. And for me, it was going fast. And so it was, the combination of seeing these Manitoba Marathon athletes followed by the question of, how can I do that? It was just a really natural progression.
Incredible. Now, I guess your events in the Olympics were the shorter distances, correct?
That is correct. I did the 100 meter, 200 meter, and 400 meter, which allowed me to also do the 4x100 meter relay and the 4x400 meter relay, where I won my bronze medal.
Fantastic. Was that early on, or did you know you were fast really quick? Because, everyone's a little different.
Yeah, I think your body is set up different, whether it's long arms and short torso or stamina, where you can just go for days. For me, it was my attention span. I liked anything under about a minute worth of concentration, and I could concentrate at 110% for about 50 seconds, and after that, I kind of get bored. So sprinting worked out really, really well.
So lead us along in your story, Colin. How old were you when you really started to get more serious?
Well, I started in 89, and so I would have been 10 years old. And then at about 14, I went to my first national championships. And I thought, in, you know, looking through a little kid's eyes, that this was just another track meet. And I accidentally won. And I beat the Canadian champion. And it became very confusing as to why people were really upset that I was there. And I just was there to have fun. I didn't plan on trying to make the national team at that point or anything. And I actually indirectly qualified for the World Championships in 1994. And wasn't allowed to go because I was too young.
So, okay, remind us again, how old were you?
14.
So you're 14, 15 years old. Either way, you're young and you're already a national champion and kind of a surprise. Now did it snowball pretty quick then? People kind of turned their heads and went, wait a second, who's this kid?
Well, I went from being, you know, no different than any athlete. You know, you go from being the fastest on your street to the fastest in your neighborhood, and then the fastest in the city. You know, as you progress, and you know, I had raced at Western Canada Games and Canada Games, so I had a sense of who was around. But you know, to finish on the top of the podium at a nationals, it didn't even really it didn't sink in.
What do you think it was? I mean, what made you so? What makes you? I mean, I know you're still fast. You're still training. What makes you so fast? What makes a wheelchair athlete fast?
I think that simplified training at that time, it was very general. I was I went to the Grant Park track a couple days ago, and I did one of my workouts from when I was a little kid just for fun.
No way.
Yep, I did the exact same workout as I remember it.
And how did it go?
It was fantastic. I had just as much fun. And those fundamentals, though, like my coach, Sandy Reddy, at the time was, she had coached, you know, some pretty high-level athletes. And so she had both the grassroots and the high-performance side. And I think, you know what, she set me up on the right path right from the beginning.
Talk about that path. Because I think now, I mean, sort of up till now, what we're hearing is, I mean, you're on a good path. You're having fun. You enjoyed it. You were pretty fast, obviously. But this kind of surprised you. But now, right, it's interesting. When we have nothing to lose and we don't really know how good we are, it's not that hard to be good. All of a sudden, we kind of know. Did that change things for you a little bit, or where'd your path go from there?
It did. I think that anytime you reach a new level, you always try and extract a little bit more out of that level. And I would say that athletes in general are a little bit greedy, that they're always pushing the envelope. And I think that although that's good, I think every once in a while you need to go back to the fundamentals. And I can think back to 5 or 6 different points in my 30-year career that, you know, I've just reflected on things aren't currently working, whatever they are. And, you know, I do a hard restart on my the equivalent of a computer. I do Control-Alt-Delete and bring everything back to zero. I do a system restore. And I always go back to those fundamentals. And it's having fun, you know, having a really good complement of speed and speed endurance. Because if you can only last 60% of a race, it doesn't matter how fast that first 60% went.
So after this national championship win and you're on the path, lead us down it farther. I mean, just so you listening know, this guy's a 4-time Paralympian. So there's quite a journey to talk about yet, and I'm really excited about it because that's not common. By the way, going once isn't really that common, to be honest. So 4 times going, but you had a ways to go before your first one. So first one was in 96, so now you got to sort of bridge the gap, and you obviously just kept training and getting better and better. So tell us some of that story.
Well, after having an amazing Canadian championships in 1994, winning my first championship, I went to World Championships the year later, and you know, going from the big fish in the little pond to being a minnow in the ocean, you know, all of a sudden I'm racing against the guys that I've seen on TV, I've read in the newspaper, and there wasn't a really natural segue. It was kind of like getting catapulted. I kind of expected that there would have been 2 or 3 other levels in between. And all of a sudden, here I am, and I'm sitting next to, you know, I remember these guys like it was yesterday. Like the world record holder in the 100 meter was sitting next to me in the 100 meter at World Championships. And the best part about it is that at 16 years old, or even 17 years old, I'm not smart enough to be afraid yet. Right. And that to me was the most honest sort of way to operate. I showed up to the track at the Paralympics in 96, my very first race, I've only ever gotten ready for medium level competitions before, nothing like the Paralympics. So I don't understand the staging. I don't understand the specific training times and the warm-up times of the warm-up track. And I show up to the track, and my coach is in the infield, and he's waving at me like he's trying to wave down an airplane. And I just casually wave back. I think that he's just marking where he is, just so I can see him with all the people around. And I said, hey, and my coach says, where have you been? I said, well, what do you mean? He goes, well, you're racing in 30 minutes. And the call room closes in 25 minutes before the race. So I've got literally 5 minutes to warm up. Mm-hmm. And I look at my chair and I thought, well, at least I pumped up my tires before I got there, because there's absolutely no time. I had to make sure that I had a left and a right glove. And I basically just jumped in my chair and went.
That's unbelievable. And this is at the Olympic Games. Like, but true, it's your first one. I mean, so leading up, how did you qualify for these games? That must have been a big meet too.
Yeah, the Canadian Championships served as the qualifying. And I remember that again like it was yesterday. I've got for some things, I seem to have a really good memory, and then I can't remember where my keys are.
Join the rest of us.
So I went to Canadian Championships in Montreal, and I ended up coming in second in every single event. And at that time, based on the depth of the competition and the qualifying standards, if you came top two in Canada, you automatically went to the Paralympics. So that was it.
Tell us about that. You said the staging room.
Yeah, there's several steps. You know, you do your warm up. You can interact with your coach, your mechanic, if you need something tweaked on your chair, sort of like NASCAR pit lane, and then you get ushered into this. After you're warmed up, you get ushered to this this tent, and it's 170 degrees because it's Atlanta in August, and there's no air movement because they make sure they close all the doors, all the walls are all closed in, nice and steamy. And then you sit in there and you think about all of the terrifying things that are about to happen for your first race, especially if you've never done this before. And you get to meet your competitors literally side by side. And some of them are smiling because they know that they're going to do really well. And some of them look like they might eat you.
I was going to ask, what was that like? Did you talk to any of them? And were there some that you were with in that, you know, in that tent, in that sauna of a tent? Atlanta was ridiculously hot. Were there some that were kind of trying to intimidate you, or what was that? What was that like? What was the dynamic?
I don't think they were actively trying to intimidate me. I think they did a really good job of intimidating me regardless. One of the things that really sort of that sits with me now is that I was so fortunate to be so young and go. My peer group that I had been racing with, all the young guys, they never made it from all the other countries. So although I had these competitors that I had shared the track with, there were very few that I actually knew when it came time to go to my first Paralympics.
So how did that race go? How did your very first Olympic race go?
It went really, really well. I got on the start line, the gun goes off, and you know, all of those years of training, all of those repetitive movements, my brain and my body and my heart knew exactly what to do, and then all of a sudden it was done. And I made it to the next round. It was unbelievable.
Amazing. Before we talk about even more Olympics on the way, I want to talk a little bit about wheelchair, being a track athlete in a wheelchair. That's an experience so many of us don't have. It's incredible. You must have calluses, blisters. What's the greatest challenge to being a great wheelchair athlete?
I think trying to stay injury-free. Based on the human body and all of the anatomy, our upper body is not designed to do what we're doing. And there's a lot of risk for overuse and acute injuries. I have been super fortunate that in my 30 years, I've only been injured two or three times, and they've been really short-lived. So I have never missed out an entire season due to an injury. I've never had to rehab, you know, with the long-term plan of finally coming back. And you know, just keeping that certain level of shape, stretching a lot, and just looking after your body.
Now, in some sports, probably all sports, there's, you know, a certain drill that you just, you got to do it, but you just hate, you know. Or, you know, you just don't want to do that drill. Is there that in athletics for a wheelchair athlete?
Yeah, there's depending on what you specialize in, your body is sort of designed for either sprinting, middle distance, or long distance. So, you know, the sprinters never like the long distance pushes that are necessary for maintenance. And the long distance guys never like having to sprint because they're used to just getting up to that cruise control, you know, and keeping that pace the entire time. And so for me, it's right in the middle. It's the difference between finishing a 400 strong and being able to pace yourself for an 800. 600 meters is my absolute nemesis. It's not a sprint, and it's not long enough that you can sort of pack a lunch and get comfortable. And it never goes well. Even when it goes well, it never really does go well.
Never really feels that good, does it?
You always coast in on fumes, and you're usually green around the gills for a little while after. And more recently, in order to get ready for whatever this next competition season will look like, I've actually been beating myself up. I've been doing these workouts that were just terrifying, mainly because right now I'm sort of overseeing my own program. And, you know, I've always benefited from coaches that were really hard on me that knew what I needed to be able to be ready 6 months from now. And so I'm starting to embrace being my own slave driver.
I want to ask one more question just about the sport itself, and then we're going to move on from those. Then I want to hear about your whole experience at the 96 Olympics. It seems to me you're dealing with a whole thing about equipment. There's so much that's different and so many more factors, I think, for you guys than for someone who literally stands on the track and runs. Those challenges I'm not as familiar with. What does it all entail? What do you think all had to come together for you to have these great races?
Well, I think confidence in your equipment. We spend a lot of time in the off season getting our chairs ready so you don't have to be messing around with it the day before your race. There's always something that happens inevitably that, you know, you blow a tire or you break a wheel and you have to sort of roll with those punches. But to have a chair that is just nice and practical and not finicky is when I notice I've done my best performances. And there's a bell curve because you've got a brand new chair, like a brand new pair of shoes that are super uncomfortable. And then you've got the ones that are held together with duct tape on the other end of the continuum. That middle point, if you do it really right, that middle point is when your most important race is, where they're comfy but not falling apart yet.
Yeah. And do you find, did you actually try and sort of time that in your training and stuff?
Absolutely. There is a particular point in the season for the last 20 years that I have gone down and had my racing chairs built. And it's basically, I have to be in enough shape that my size, my BMI, my overall fitness represents what my body will look like in peak competition time. And at the same time, I also have to build in 6 weeks, 10 weeks to break one in, because it's never quite perfect on the first day. And I can't afford to be trying to break one in at a competition. So end of February, early March is typically when I get a chair made, and it's usually ready to go by May when we open up our outdoor season in Canada.
It's fascinating to me that, you know, the equipment plays such a role. And I just thought of that as I asked that first question, but I would not even think every season you build that into your training. You train your chair, for Pete's sake. Do you always train in the chair that you're going to race in, or does that wear it out? How does that look?
Yes and yes. I always train in the same chair. Okay. And yes, it wears it out. Unfortunately, it takes so long to break one in, and no chair is ever alike. So breaking it in, it's sad to say, but breaking it in is weakening it as you're going along. You're always sort of tweaking it as you're getting used to it. And your body has to adapt to the new position as well. There's always these little nuances of, you know, your hip width or your knee angle, anything that your body is able to adapt to that your chair wasn't willing to sort of concede.
So 96 is your first Olympics. You made it past that very first moment, that first race. You were happy with it. You got to advance. What happened from there?
Well, there was a 100 meter, a 200 meter, a 400 meter, an 800 meter, and two relays after that. And I think to myself at 41 years old now, I wonder how the heck I did that. Like if I did half of that, I'd be out of commission for like weeks. And I managed to just, I was racing twice a day for 8 or 9 days in a row. And like, thank goodness for youth.
Yeah. So your top performance was in that relay in 96 for sure. Where did that fit into the mix and the menu of all the races you just mentioned?
I like how you compare it to the menu, because the relays are the last thing to go at the end of every games. So this is literally the dessert after a appetizer, after a main course. You know, it's just really your comparison is very fitting, because you know you've waited the entire time for this. And we had a 4x100 meter relay where we ended up winning the gold and getting disqualified. We extended one of our exchanges past the zone by literally half an inch, and unfortunately, half an inch is half an inch too long. They called us on it, and that was it. Now the 4x400 meter relay comes shortly after that, and if I've ever seen a bunch of guys determined to make something out of nothing, you know, we had all been in that previous relay where we ended up with nothing, and we weren't gonna take no for an answer. And unfortunately, I blew a tire on the start line. Sitting on the start line, getting ready, all of a sudden I hear this hissing noise, and I look down, and all of a sudden I'm about half an inch or 3/4 of an inch leaning to the right, and my mechanic comes hurtling over the barricade with his toolbox and his pump over his shoulder like Rambo, and he flips me upside down, pulls my tire off like a dog tearing into a chew toy, swaps this tire out, and the official comes over and says, "Oh no, you're not allowed to repair chairs on the track. You know, you guys are disqualified." My teammate, as fast of a thinker as he is, he says, "Well, no, we've got repair time. It's built into the rules." And the guy says, the official says, "Oh, I don't think so." And they go into this 400-page operational manual. And I watch him thumbing through page after page looking for this particular, you know, rule. Yeah. And by the time he got 2 pages in, I've got a brand new tire and it's not an issue anymore. I don't know whether it's in there for the rules, but it got us an extra 20 minutes or 15 minutes to get everything sorted out. And I was ready to go then.
You know, hang on. Us elite athletes, like we visualize, we prepare, like this is the 4x400 final in the Paralympics. You obviously were prepared. Then this happens. You've been literally thrown over by your equipment guy fixing your tire. You've watched this with, obviously your heart must have been going 100 miles an hour, hoping they find the right rule. What, Colin, how did you get back into any kind of state where you could put together a great performance?
I have absolutely no idea. I think that it's possible that, kind of like riding a roller coaster where you go upside down a few times, it's possible that my mechanic, you know, he flipped me a couple times and reset something and, you know, shook me like an Etch-a-Sketch, and all of a sudden I was ready to go again.
Yeah.
I got into my lane, the gun goes off, and I ran an absolutely phenomenal 400 meter, and I tag my teammate, and we were in, I think, second place at the time. And I hear another hissing noise, and I think my chair's cursed. And then I realize it's his tire. So now whatever worked for us to get my tire fixed, we don't get to put the pause button and stop the race and fix it. He ran his entire 400 on a flat tire. We were in dead last in the final exchange. And my teammate that anchored managed to squeak out a bronze medal out of the most horrific of scenarios.
What an incredible story. And even just now that you told us how important the equipment is and that actually happened. I mean, all the time that you put into your equipment and those things are still out of your control. A lot of athletes talk about what you can control and what you can't. And all elite athletes will tell you, you got to figure that out. So obviously, I mean, your teammate who did the second leg of that race figured it out somehow. He did 400 meters. How hard is that? You tell us how hard that is to do that on a flat tire. I don't know.
It is almost impossible, and this guy was probably 200 pounds. And the track in Atlanta when it's 110 degrees Fahrenheit is soggy like a marshmallow. I cannot imagine what kind of a boat anchor he felt like he was dragging for 400 meters. 400 meters ruins you when you've got all the air in your tires and you're fresh.
What an incredible thing. So then when you finish and you finish in third, the big comeback, what was that celebration like?
It was unbelievable. It was, you know, we meet everybody back in the mix zone because we're ushered off the track after our leg, just to make sure there's no accidents. And I go and I give my anchor teammate a slap on the shoulder and say, thanks so much for what you did. And I look at him and I don't want to be within a 10-foot radius. He looks like he's going to be sick. I think he officially coasted in on fumes. Even though we all talk about coasting in on fumes, I think his were extra thin fumes.
Colin, after that experience, you have an Olympic medal. The percentage of people in this world who can say they have an Olympic medal is really, really small. So why not just, you know, sit back, literally sit back and say, man, I got an Olympic medal. Here I go. What spurred you on after 96? And it really did, as we know.
Yeah, I think that those crossroads are definitely... they're definitely a real thing. I remember the idea of wondering whether this was my peak. And you know what, at 17 years old, you're also not smart enough to overthink things, which I think was in my favor. You know, if I was in my 30s at that point and I had won my medal, I would probably think, you know, the young guys are nipping at my heels and maybe it's time to call it a good career. But for me, this was like, it was just an amazing jumping off point. And I saw it as such. And a couple of my competitors that were my age, we were talking about this before the interview. One of them quit the day after I beat him in like the semifinal in the 200 meter, and he said he had just had enough. That was that. So the jumping off point for one athlete is the swan song of the other.
Yeah, for sure. So 96 is done, and you keep training. Where are you? Are you still in Manitoba now? Who are you training with? What does it all look like? What does your life look like at this point?
Well, I'm training in Winnipeg full time. I'm 17 years old, so I'm still in high school. And
I forget you're 17. You're hard to imagine 17-year-olds are winning bronze medals at the Paralympic Games.
Yeah, and so I had a coach in Winnipeg that unfortunately, just before the Paralympics, had moved to Ottawa with her family to pursue an amazing job. And so my dad actually was sort of coaching me with their supervision and with their input. And I actually asked one of the coaches from the Paralympics that had overseen my preparation training, the one that I casually waved to when I was late for my race. I thought, you know what, if he can tolerate me in that scenario, maybe we'd be a good team. And so this is back long before email and Skype and Facebook. So I actually called him, had a conversation with him, and I said, look, you know, I had an amazing first Paralympics. I really appreciate your patience, you know, your understanding where I'm coming from. And like, would you be interested in coaching me? And up until this point, he's never coached anybody long distance. And at 17, I'm not moving to Quebec. And so we actually developed a really efficient program where my dad would still act as like a liaison, make sure that I was able to understand my workouts, and he would do the timing for the testing and so on and so on. And these workouts, I remember I had never used Microsoft Excel before, and these workouts would come, and it was always exciting. It was kind of like a Christmas present. Every 3 weeks, I'd get another email and I'd go and print it up, and there would be my task for the next month. And it was so exciting. And he coached me from 1997 to 2012. Wow. So a really, really long relationship.
Okay, so what was your next Olympics after 96?
96 led to a couple world championships, which was good. And then Sydney in 2000, which, you know, that, you talk about different eras. You know, there's, you know, naive 17-year-old me, and then there becomes, you know, neurotic 21-year-old me.
So neurotic sounds like, did it change a bit for the negative, or what happened?
I don't know if it was, in hindsight, I don't know if it was necessarily negative. It was different. I've had way more experience now. I've raced internationally a bunch of times. I actually know how fast everybody else is. And I swear, sometimes ignorance is bliss. I really like not having any care in the world because I didn't quite understand what was going on, because you can't get terrified of that. Yeah. And so I'm trying to qualify for Sydney in 2000, and we have a world championships, and all of a sudden, you know, I'm doing well, but it, even though I'm as fast as I was in 96 or if not faster, I don't feel like it because I'm comparing it differently. I'm starting to look at the microseconds or the milliseconds, and you know, the starting to become a little more obsessed with trying to get that perfect race. Because before, I didn't even know what a perfect race was.
What was your expectation at the 2000 Olympics? And were you still doing all these events?
My expectation at the Paralympics, was my second Paralympics, was to do better than the first. As you know, that's a very nice general goal. I just want to be better than. And it didn't go that way. I got cut from the relay team the night before the games started. We did a time trial that they told me it was relay practice. I've been on the relay team now for 4 years. I assume that this is relay practice for all of us. I don't realize that they're doing a time trial, and I had just a really bad performance. I had a really bad first 30-meter time trial, and I had an abnormally bad start for a couple of the testing, and all of a sudden I'm second fiddle. I'm now the alternate on the relay team.
So how did that work, Colin? That you had to go then and race at the Olympics and all of your individual events. You're not on the relay. You've gotten this blow to your confidence. How did you battle that?
Well, the first thing that I thought was that, not understanding how this relay was selected, I assumed that the relay team was going to be the same relay team as Atlanta. And so in the back of my mind, and this is where the sports psychology really comes in, I had visualized myself being on the medal-winning relay team. And I didn't understand necessarily how I got on the first one because of, you know, how naive I was. Yeah. And I just assumed that it was already decided. So to hear all of a sudden that you're not, it's extremely startling. And I didn't have the wherewithal to recenter myself before my first individual race, like 4 days later or 3 days later when we finally got into the village. And it was just a really bad place to be in my brain for those 10 days.
Yeah. So you said 2000 didn't go as well as 96. And you know, I mean, there's some things that stand to reason that way. So now, just like 96, you had this great moment. And I asked what kept you going instead of you resting on your laurels. Now it didn't go well. And now you still kept going, but for a completely different reason. What a journey. You've been up the mountain, down the mountain. You're in the valley. You know, and some of it you're not even understanding. You can't really put it together. Keep us going in your story.
Well, I think those valleys you talk about, you know, the bigger the sample you have, the less flash in the pants you are as to whether you did it or not. So the bigger the sample, the longer you can potentially be on the top. But the other sad reality is that the longer you go, your deficits end up being equally as big. And, you know, I had a very unfortunate showing probably from 2000 all the way to 2002 before my next world championships. And but yeah, you know, it's similar to the stock market. If you just wait it out, eventually it does go back up with confidence and with perseverance and trying to, you know, learn from the mistakes, not counting your chickens before they hatch, I think was probably my biggest takeaway. And then we raced at World Championships in 2002, and it just so happened that our star teammate in the relay didn't compete. So all of a sudden, there's two things that happen, is that we've lost the guy that was typically the one that would make or break our relay. And second of all, we had to figure out how to still be great. And it kind of reminds me of like a Disney movie where you've got like the average Joes. We were all good athletes, but you know, without that one superstar, our confidence was it wasn't the same. We didn't have the swagger, and we had to figure out how to do it. And you know, I had a chat with my coach before we sort of assembled the relay that year, And he said, you know, that it was my turn to start driving the bus and you know, getting these guys excited. And I think he saw a lot in me with my potential that I was going to be around for a while and I could possibly, you know, have some value added, you know, notwithstanding just the 400 meter that you do on behalf of the team, but to get everybody riled up. And so I at 22 years old, sitting amongst a bunch of guys that are essentially my equals, I'm not any better than them. We're all in the same boat here. You know, I had to give sort of my first halftime speech, and it was bizarre. I remember it like it was yesterday, and I could recite it. And in hindsight, it's not very inspiring, but you know what? It got the job done, and we came home with two bronze medals from those two relays without our star athlete.
Incredible. So you were given this new role. And did this spur you on to the next Olympics?
Yes, there is definitely some momentum that gets built in those moments. And talking about the flat tire in Atlanta, something bad always happens in the relay. And it's kind of like waiting to the end of the movie to see the you know, the either the peak or the valley. And in our 400 meter, my teammate broke his wrist in the middle of his 400 meters. And we all know how unfortunate it is to have to do 400 meters flat out. And we also know, I know now what it looks like when you have to run 400 meters on a flat tire because my teammate had to do it. And now I'm watching a guy and I can actually hear him grimacing from 200 meters away, pushing with a broken wrist.
What an incredible feat, an incredible act of courage. Wow. And you had a great finish.
Yeah, bronze medal, and it was way closer than the last one. We didn't just eke it out. We actually were contending for silver right up until the end, despite, you know, my buddy blowing his wrist out.
Okay, so take us to the next Olympics. How did you get there, and what was that like?
Well, we talk about the valleys. My next Paralympics wasn't until 2008. So I missed 2004. So that went, I basically had to figure out how to extend myself without a major competition between 2002 and 2008 for Beijing. And that was a long time. And I wouldn't trade being in that valley. I wouldn't trade that for anything in the world. I had my coach from Quebec and we were meeting a couple times a year specifically, but he was also the national team coach. So I was also seeing him at all the big competitions without having to go out to see him disrupting my life and paying extra to have those really important one-on-one sessions. Well, in 2007, I had a track meet in Quebec and we always used those. I'd stay a couple extra days. We'd do a little bit of a training camp and we'd talk about what the plan was for the next year or what the next 6 months would look like. And I went for lunch with him at Mike's in Sherbrooke.
Okay.
And I don't know why, but that just stands out. We were sitting out on the patio and he says, so do you think you want to go to Beijing? And I said, yeah, I want to keep going. And this is kind of like those incremental stops where you could turn back if you wanted. Yeah. I always had the choice. It wasn't like I was going full bore. You always have those sit back and reflect moments. And I said, yeah, I want to go to Beijing. And he says, I've got some good news and some bad news. I said, okay, well, what's the good news? He goes, I have the standards right here. And this is like the first day that they've been published. And I said, well, what's the bad news? He goes, I have the standards right here.
So it was good and bad.
It was good and bad. It was good to have the end of a season, an end of a successful season, end on a good note, with then the next Mount Everest directly in front of you. And I swear he's a pretty clever guy. He would never, this wouldn't be accidental. He didn't want me to bail on the idea if I had seen these as an unsurmountable challenge. So I think that he waited until my confidence was as high as it was and then threw this on me. And I had to knock off half a second in the 100 meter in order to qualify for Beijing.
That's a lot.
That is a ton, considering that there was only 14 of those seconds to begin with.
Wow.
So I say to him, I said, well, what are you, like, how are we going to do this? I'm fascinated at this point, more of like a psychological component of how do you think we're going to do this? Because I understand anatomy, and I also understand talent, and I've got a little bit of both, but there's no guarantee they're going to necessarily get me that much quicker in that short of a time. And he says, well, I think you need to move to Sherbrooke. And I'm like, oh. I'm like, but I don't speak French. And I live in Winnipeg. And he gives me this really ashamed look like, you need to figure this out. And he's like, get there. And I'm like, all right, well, let's. What is this going to look like? 2 extra days in Sherbrooke. I find a place to live. I get registered for my first semester at Bishop's University in September. And I go home. My dad had come to visit with me to this track meet. So on the way home, we got upgraded to first class, which is never a bad thing. And so what we do is he and I are sitting there next to each other, and I've got a cocktail napkin with all of the things that I need to save and move with me to Sherbrooke on one side, and on the other side, I've got all the things that I need to sell. That was literally how fast this materialized. And so that was late August. By the 6th of September, I had already moved to Sherbrooke. And was in school.
So there you were. Changed your life. Boom. Huge curve in the road. You took it and it paid off. I mean, you said that was your next Olympics. How'd you get there? Did you? I mean, obviously you shaved that half second off.
I did. I went from 15 seconds flat to 14 and a half seconds. Broke the Canadian record in the process. You know, that in itself was amazing, because the idea of going sub 15 for me had always been one of those, if I could only go sub 15, it's kind of like going sub 10 seconds in the 100 for able-bodied.
So you're competitive and you go to the 2008 Olympics. And how does that ring true? Were you competitive and how did that go?
Yeah, I broke the Canadian record in Montreal in May. It was the second last chance I had to qualify. And it's like a leaderboard in golf where you have the best times compared to the rest of the world. So it's not just the fastest in your classification and the fastest in your event. It's actually, I'm being compared to like the shot putter. So I have to go fast, and it doesn't matter who's in my race. I could come in first by a mile and still not go, based on the fact that it's not competitive against the rest of the world. So I move into like the 6th position in the world based on this new personal best and Canadian record. And my coach is so excited. He comes running over, and I finish the 100 meter at 36 kilometers an hour. So I stop pushing at the finish line, and I basically coast around another 300 meters to the finish line again. And it's taken him next to no time. And my coach was in pretty good shape. I've never seen him run so fast. And he almost tripped because he couldn't believe what his stopwatch said. And I guess he was running to the official timer to figure out whether this was the wind was going to be a factor, because if it's too great of a tailwind, you don't get it counted. And so anyway, after he's out of breath and I'm out of breath, we both sort of emerge at the finish line. And he says, well, you probably should pack your bags. You're going. And it was just a mathematical certainty that if you got this time and you were ranked this in the world, and there was no disqualifications and no illegal wind, it was a done deal. So I actually in May knew that I was going, May or end of June, knew that I was going to the Paralympics in October, which was amazing because I could just focus on training and being ready.
And how did the 2008 Paralympics go?
The 2008 Paralympics went good. I wouldn't say it was my most fantastic. There's a lot of emphasis on doing well, and there's something about the ambiance or the vibe that I get at a Paralympics. You know, and like I said in my first games, it was so much easier to just not know how big this was, because, you know, you arrive at a moment where you start overthinking things, you know, there's just all of this noise, and I've worked exclusively with some really good sports psychologists. And, you know, trying to block out the noise, trying to embrace the excitement over the anxiety. I can't remember who said it, but, you know, trying to get those butterflies to fly in formation rather than all over the place. But no, it was decent. I think I made the 2 semifinals. it's unfortunate to break the Canadian record so early in the season. It would have been way better to have broken the Canadian record in the middle of the 100-meter final.
But that's how sports goes. And you still weren't done. 2008, man, you just kept going and going and going. Was 2012 your final Olympics?
Yeah, 2012 was definitely an interesting one. I had decided that I was going to move back to Winnipeg after the Games. I had gotten married on December 31st, 2011, to an absolutely wonderful woman in Winnipeg. So all roads pointed back to me moving back to Winnipeg. It made the most amount of sense. My family's here. My wife is here. And I had sort of felt like I had reached my potential training in Sherbrooke. And it was the right time on like five different levels. And so I focus on the Games. There was some decent performances. There was a couple, not disappointments, but you know, we missed the final for the 4x400 meter relay by, I think it was 0.2 seconds. And you know, you got four guys that are doing 400 meters. Every single one of us knows exactly where we could have found 0.2 seconds, right? It's such a micro measurement for such a massive disappointment. That was sort of the nail in the coffin. Those are always the last, the relays are always the last of the Games. You know, I made a final in the 100 meter, which was pretty impressive because I always have this type of push where I get off the line really, really well. And it's a little bit of a, you know, a peak at 80 meters and then hold on. And in this particular case, you know, I was pretty impressed. Like, I had a decent launch off the start line. I had perfect grip. And I accelerated right to the end. And it was the difference between making the eighth spot in that final or being ninth and not having anything else to do that week.
So 2012, I want to hear the story bridging the gap between making a decision that was your last Olympic Games and did you continue to race? You know, I mean, you're training now, so I know you didn't stop moving, but in what way were you moving and where did coaching fit into this now?
Well, I've never actually coached. I've mentored. And one of the differences is that I think that athletes have a lot of input and a lot of contribution that they can make to an up-and-coming athlete. But there is something I don't feel confident coaching while I'm still competing because I'm in a different place in my mind. I'm not objective. I'm not standing back and solely looking at that other athlete. I'm still looking at it through a competitor's eyes.
Yeah.
And for me, you know, I moved back to Winnipeg and I actually still had my coach from Quebec coaching me because I hadn't decided I was going to retire. It was, you know, a disappointing Games and a lot of people thought that the day I moved back to Winnipeg, I was hanging up my gloves and I just wanted a change of venue. Yeah. I just wanted to come back home and, you know, enjoy my new family and enjoy seeing my old family more than once or twice a year. And just move on and try some new things. And so my old coach actually coached me for the 2013 season after the Games. After that, I went to his typical training camp down in Florida. And based on a lot of things, I decided that I needed to make a couple more changes in addition to Winnipeg. And I changed coaches. And it was one of the most exhilarating moments I've had that didn't include me physically in my racing chair. And it's funny because I had trained with this previous coach since I was a little kid. So that's all I knew. And to realize that we had sort of come full circle or we had peaked, you know, no different than any relationship or any sort of equation, you realize that you've maxed out and I needed to make this change. Well, I start Googling because that's how it has to be because I don't know how to do it any other way. I start Googling how to pick a coach, how to change coaches. Like, is there an etiquette? Do I have to give him notice? Do I, you know, I don't want to get sued by the labor laws. So anyway, I Googled the heck out of this for a while. And it just so happens that my previous coach, my very first coach ever, is married to the head coach of Athletics Canada. So I email him and I said, I know you're in between Winnipeg and Ottawa a lot, but if you're ever in Winnipeg for more than a couple days, I'd love to go for a coffee and pick your brain on how to get the most out of this next experience? You know, what should I be looking for in a coach? And I had asked a bunch of other people and I had read a bunch of books because it's kind of nerdy, but it's a neat way to not commit. I can do that in the privacy. Nobody needs to know that I'm terrified of what this outcome is going to be and I'm trying to do my research. So anyway, I meet with Alec Gardner, you know, a couple times at the Starbucks on Taylor. And it's so funny because similar to my cocktail napkin on the Air Canada cocktail napkin, which I still kept, I actually plasticized it. I sat with him for two or three meetings and I would offer to buy him, you know, a $4 coffee. And I would pick his brain for probably $1,500 worth of knowledge. So I always felt like I was ahead on the equation based on the cost of his wisdom. And it just so happened that after the games, his contract didn't get renewed with Athletics Canada. And it was interesting because I read this in the newspaper the day before we were going for coffee. And I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, like, does he want to cancel coffee? This is a bad day. It's like getting cut from the national team, you know, from a coaching perspective. And I don't know how he's taken it. This might not be a surprise. He might have been blindsided. So I sit with him at Starbucks and you always start with that sort of idle chit chat. Nobody wants to commit to like the elephant in the room. And, you know, he actually asks me, because we were still talking about my issue of trying to find a coach. He says, he goes, why don't we just get to it? How about I coach you? And I'm thinking to myself, I was asking for somebody to help me do my taxes and the Minister of Finance just offered to do it for me. Just, it was like having a judge represent you in your parking ticket. And it just goes to show that, you know, athletes don't give themselves enough credit, that you always think that you're lesser than what you probably are, because he obviously saw something in me or else he wouldn't have extended that. And I started working with him in 2013 and I PB'd in the 400 meter in 2013. No way. There was this renewed confidence having somebody in my corner that was training with me in person every day. He'd drag out workouts if I was fresh. He'd cut workouts short if I was feeling a little bit bagged out. He just had that finger on the pulse. And I got faster and older, and I never got hurt. And I think back to that first year, and you don't know how big of a change it's going to be until it actually happens.
What an incredible change and result. But some might be wondering, as I am, what were you training for? Were you training to, you know, strive for another games, another world championships, or was it just to train? I mean, it's been so long. Now you even made this change. Tell me about that.
Well, I think that there's an athlete mentality that I see in myself as well as other people, so I know it's not solely me, is that you're only as good as your last race. And there is something about not wanting to leave on that low note and you know, thinking about, you know, London wasn't a disappointment. It was by far, if I had to pick a games to finish on, that would have been it. I had my wife and my mom in the stands and I could hear them. Oh. And if you can imagine hearing two people out of 100,000, wow, packed stadium, it's just unbelievable. I swear. And it's funny because I met them after, and I did this with my dad in 2000. I ask them, or I guess where they're sitting, and then they tell me whether I picked right, because I swear I could hear them as I went by. But no, I think that there's games that you wish you had done better at. And, you know, sometimes you get beat and sometimes you don't win. And it's funny, after 30 years of racing, I've got about 9 different categories of how races end. And it's not win or lose anymore. There are so many other things to take away. And I never arrived at that I'm sick of this and I want to quit. So I just keep on going. It's kind of like not receiving your notice for retirement in the mail. So you just keep on going. And meanwhile, you know, that your boss thinks you're done and you keep on showing up to work. So they keep on paying you. And there's got to be some kind of a sitcom based on that, you know, the guy that didn't get the note. But no, so, and I, you know, back to 2013, I'm having fun. I'm training in Winnipeg. I'm married. I'm back in university. I actually decided I was going to finish my social work degree. And so I've got just this really amazing diversified portfolio of life. And, you know, I've got a fantastic family. I've got my school's on the right track. And I've got this amazing coach. I'm never sore. I'm always fresh. Training less, training harder, racing less, racing better. And I had my season's best in Winnipeg, racing with the kids in Winnipeg, the able-bodied athletes. We put together a 400 meter, and it was supposed to be just for fun. And what happened was is that they're so much quicker off the start line that I chase them for 300 meters to catch up to them. But once I get to them, they're already decelerating. So it is like a battle of will between how bad do I want to catch them versus how much gas do they have left to not get caught. So it is the most hilarious yo-yo of a race to watch. It looks like I'm about to come in, you know, 5 minutes later, and then all of a sudden at about 250 meters I'm a little bit closer, and then 275 meters, and I'm gaining on these guys throughout that last corner. We come around the corner equal, shoulder to shoulder, all six of us, and it's basically whoever's got enough gas left is going to win this. And I eke out like by half a chair length the runner, and it was by far the most fun I've ever had. And these are all my coach's other athletes. So we train together. This is to me what inclusion ought to look like. You know, you're equal on the track in training, you're equal on the track in competition, and there is no Paralympic Olympic. It's just high performance.
So Colin, you're 41 now. I mean, is this getting us to 2020 here? Like, are you still doing this? Where's Alec in your life now and all that stuff? Where are you at now?
Well, that's a really good question. I didn't make the team in 2016, which was unfortunate. I qualified based on time and placing at nationals, but unfortunately, they only selected X amount of athletes. I wasn't one of them. I have to move on. But I still, again, that stubbornness, I don't think I'm done. So what ends up happening is I end up getting really, really sick in 2016, and even if I had been selected for Rio, I don't think I would have been able to compete based on how sick I got. I was dealing with massive kidney stones, and I ended up having a septic shock due to it. And so that basically put me on the sidelines for all of the rest of 2016 and all of 2017. 2018, I decide that I'm still not done. And, you know, I trained all winter after I was finally given the green light. And I show up to nationals and I win. And the funny thing is that this is exactly like when I talk about winning my very first nationals when I didn't even know what nationals was. I expect that this is going to be like getting my butt kicked. The writing's on the wall. I was basically doing nothing for a year and a half. And I end up winning by quite a bit. And I've got an interview ready speech for when they stick the microphone in my face saying, you know what? I've had a good run. I'm glad I was able to come back for this race, but you know what? My body is just telling me that it's not time. And they stick the microphone in my face, and the only thing that comes out is, I'm back.
No way.
Yeah. All we talked about was what the next thing was going to be. And that was going to be, you know, training for that world championships next. Wow. So it's just hilarious how quickly, you know, the ups and the downs. You think you're sunk, and then you come back, and then you think you're sunk again, and you come back, and it's kind of like an unnecessary act, but part of me thinks I want to see how low I can go and still rebound. Like, that seems to be the new challenge. Like, it's, you know, it's you hurt my feelings, and I came back, and then you kicked me in the shins, and I came back, and then you pushed me over into the mud puddle, and I came back, and that seems to be what the theme has been for the last little while, is just overcoming those adversities.
Okay, so you said you won. Okay, how old were you and how old were your competitors?
I was 40, yeah. And I beat the 17-year-old. I beat the 18-year-old. I beat the 21-year-old. I think I was almost double the age of second or third place.
So you're training still, but the rest of life goes on. You've been married for quite some time now. And are you working on top of your training? And how are you blending your life right now?
Well, blending is definitely a way to describe it. It's more like throwing it in a blender and seeing what the combinations are all. You know, I think that athletes do a really good job of being athletes and focusing on the task at hand. I said, but some of the athletes that managed to survive as long as they have, and I'm starting to put myself in that category, not based on excellence, but just based on longevity, is that you throw everything in a blender and you still make it work. I'm happily married. We bought and renovated a condo in the same year that I was finishing my my social work degree and working like 45 hours a week doing my practicums, you know, and having an amazing partner in life. You know, it's just, everything is just so complementary. It's, you know, I've got, I haven't decided whether Al and I are going to continue on, because mainly based on everything else that's going on in my life, I don't feel like I'm worthy of wasting his time, because he was in it for a pound, in it for a penny, whatever that saying is. And, you know, he was completely on board with no distractions. And I don't know if I can reciprocate that at this point. So I'm training, but I'm also going back to those basics. I'm training for fun. I'm actually training at the Grant Park High School now, because that's where I went to high school. And that is also where I spent the majority of my little kid years pushing. Yeah. And you know what? The track is far from perfect, but there is a vibe that I get. You know, it's just this feeling when you come around the track, it feels so comfortable. I will train on that track until the end of time.
Colin, this is amazing. Now, normally, you know, when I'm doing these chats and these interviews and these stories and I'm hearing these stories, the fact that your athletic career has spanned more than 30 years, you're racing for real. And I'm going to come back. I'm coming back in a couple years, see where you are. Colin Matheson, incredible story, incredible stamina, and an incredible competitive, just a drive to always see what you can do next. Colin, I'm going to ask some rapid fire questions. And I rapid fire the question, you rapid fire the answer, and we'll get through these and have some fun. What's your favorite sound?
My favorite sound is when your heart rate goes up right before the gun goes off, and it's almost like intuition. I can actually feel it thump a few times quicker in between set and the gun. That is my favorite noise.
What is something that you have struggled with that continues to affect you now that no one would know looking at you?
I think the work-life balance, the athlete-life balance, I think has always been a challenge. I don't think it's a struggle, but it's definitely something that we're always striving to do a little bit better at.
Describe an ordinary moment.
Jeez, an ordinary moment would be, you know, a day where you wake up extremely excited to start the day. You do your workout, you go to work, you come home, and you spend time with your family. Far from ordinary, but it's awesome.
What is one piece of advice you want to pass along to others?
Always decide whether it's fun or not before you jump in. If you can figure out how to make it fun, then that to me is going to give you extra years of your career and let you get more out of every moment.
Share a quote you love.
Oh, Mike Tyson, everybody's got a plan till you get punched in the face.
What is your favorite failure, Colin?
Oh, my favorite failure. I've had so many of them, it's hard to distinguish. I think that those moments like in a 100-meter where you come second, but only by a hair. It's a failure based on the fact that you didn't win, but it's my favorite failure because it is such a small amount, you know that you could potentially get it the next time.
Tell us about a book you would recommend to other people and why.
Oh, that was a good question. I actually tried to prepare for this one. I like reading a lot of sociology books and social psychology, but Andre Agassi's book Open was probably, in the last little while, probably one of my more interesting reads.
Awesome. And two or three people that have affected your life and influenced you, and how did they impact you?
Well, Rick Hansen, watching him do his Man in Motion tour, at the exact same time that I also saw the Manitoba Marathon for the first time, I think that those two, they have to be considered one and the same. And, you know, Doug Grant from Manitoba Wheelchair Sports, who was always a champion for the young guys to compete at a high-performance level and did whatever he could to support us. And Sandy and Al Gardner. You know, it's kind of funny that I've got a husband and wife that are the bookends of my career.
Incredible. And what an impact. And, you know, Colin, we're doing this. We're calling this podcast Heroes in Our Midst. And here you live in our midst, still pursuing excellence. And I think every time that you get on that track, I don't think any of us know what's going to happen next for Colin Matheson. So often these stories have an end, but I think we're going to call this one to be continued. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's been wonderful.
That's four-time Paralympian Colin Matheson. What an example of endurance, motivation, and sheer determination. Thank you for your time and for your story, Colin. All the best as you set your sights on whatever is to come. Thanks for listening. And if you'd like to hear more, like us, follow us, subscribe to Heroes in Our Midst.